From Capital Analytics, I'm Abby Malone, and this is Invest Insights. Every week, we bring you perspectives, business advice, and more from the leading executives, entrepreneurs, and investors who are building, diversifying, and leading the way in the country's fastest-growing metro markets. Real leaders, real insights, right now. These are challenging times. The COVID-19 pandemic has tested our institutions, our businesses, and ourselves in ways many of us could have not predicted. When we started this podcast, we focused on crisis management as the pandemic raged. Season 2 was all about resilience in the face of uncertainty. And our new season will look at what has emerged as the dominating theme of the pandemic, transformation. From products and services and consumer relations to future plans and how these leaders themselves have personally transformed. We'll be going in depth to learn just how much our world has changed. Enjoy. I'm joined today by Andrew Wright, the CEO and founder of Franklin Street. Andrew, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Despite the challenges of this past year, Franklin Street had a number of successful leasings and sellings of retail plaza entities. While traditional brick and mortar has continued to struggle this year, how have you capitalized on market opportunities and transformed your process to continue to be successful in such a turbulent market?
Evolution, you know, or resiliency. I mean, things evolve, right? Where what was a use before, now, you know, things change and something backfills it. You know, there were a lot of empty blockbusters over time, yet there's something else in there today. And so I think in retail specifically, you've seen uses adapt several times in its history and no different really now. Some trends you saw beforehand, I mean, in terms of it's still evolving. Some trends that have been very popular is the MedTail concept. A lot of medical uses have moved into more traditional neighborhood locations that are more convenient, ample parking, amenities around them. So there's a lot of changes in the reimbursement model on healthcare that's going to continue to drive that trend. You know, there's also still thriving businesses. So while, you know, certainly a lot of people were hurt during the pandemic, business, at least here in Florida, has rebounded pretty quickly. And hopefully it stays that way. But, you know, good locations are good locations. You know, people want to be in those spots that are, you know, easy access and high desirable. So you've still been able to, you know, in those unique locations, drive it. The hardest hit are going to be the non-grocery anchored, kind of inline, tertiary market type, you know, more mom and pop businesses. They were struggling before. In an Amazon economy, they will continue to struggle. So, you know, hard to predict how that will play out. I'm not so optimistic on that segment, but, you know, in general, good locations continue to do well, and some will figure out the next use, you know, coming in.
When we spoke to you, and speaking of those unique opportunities, when we spoke to you for our Invest Tampa Bay report, you remarked that the I-4 corridor could literally be one of the best investment corridors in the entire world. And when compared to the other booming markets in Florida, including South Florida, why do you have the utmost confidence in the transformation of this particular area?
Growth would be the word. And let me be clear, South Florida is booming as well. The entire state of Florida, the Sun Belt by extension, it's the third most populous state, and it's growing at one of the fastest growth rates across the country. When you compare South Florida specifically to the Tampa Bay area, it's about double the size in population. It's about double the size in GDP. So it already is a much bigger market, more dense market, where the I-4 corridor has much larger growth rate. So if you look at population growth as an example, South Florida trails the state average, where the Tampa Bay area, Orlando, you know, that I-4 corridor area is ahead. So, you know, you're still seeing a lot of people move to South Florida, but more people as a percentage are moving here, a disproportionate share are moving here. And the same is true on GDP growth. You're seeing the economy in this area grow faster. And it's short stretch to see how that I-4 corridor could get to be, you know, more similar. Again, it's double the size down there. So I think that growth rate has a lot of runway. There's also a lot more land to be developed down in South Florida because you're up against the Everglades there. You really have a, you know, long, narrow corridor for development. So it's going to be, you know, harder for that, you know, transportation issues and other quality of living issues by comparison. New affordable housing prices are going to be more difficult down there. So I just think that there's a number of things that over a long period of time, you're going to see more growth in the I-4 corridor than you are in South Florida. Now, I would talk about a couple things down in South Florida, particularly with the migration coming from the Northeast. Southeast Florida is much more appealing to businesses fleeing New York and New York City than Tampa, Orlando, or Jacksonville would be. And as they relocate down there, I think the real estate markets are going to perform very well. You're going to bring a lot more jobs, you know, down there. So it's whether or not we'll be able to keep up in the I-4 corridor with the head start that they have, both reputationally and also the quality of the supply that's in place. So, we do have a couple major projects throughout, these areas. Tampa's got, one of the largest redevelopment projects in the country, the $3 billion Water Street Tampa project. But, they still have to catch up.
You just said that South Florida is attracting more businesses from the Northeast. How can the Tampa Bay Orlando corridor area be more attractive to attract those CEOs that are relocating at the moment?
Yeah, I think it's telling our story. I mean, the Tampa Bay area, the I-4 corridor has, a lot going for it that, South Florida does not. I mean, traffic, I'll start with that. The convenience of the market, the cost of living, is another point. Good access to private schools. I think we all, as a state, education is something that holds us back, and not for the C-level people, but for all the workers in line. Good quality education compared to people coming from Ohio or Michigan or New York. I mean, they're taking a step back in some respects. So trying to focus on that, trying to focus on our public transportation system. I think the rail project that's been ongoing for years, connecting South Florida to Orlando, is a fantastic start, getting people being able to move around. It's economically beneficial. People who can't afford cars or long commutes all of a sudden have access to jobs much more affordably. So I think, in Tampa, we have a lot to offer that we, don't talk about. We have three professional sports teams in the Tampa Bay region. By the way, I got to plug a Stanley Cup champion, a World Series runner up, and now in the Super Bowl, first home team to host the Super Bowl. That type of notoriety, people come in here, the Riverwalk development that happened in Tampa, really focusing on that quality of living is key. And I think if we can work together more to tell that story and partner together on the economic development side to be proactive in recruiting, that they're going to do more than their fair share.
Over the next 12 to 24 months, there will be ongoing challenges with distressed and special assets. How are you transforming your process and preparing your operations to provide the best services for these situations?
Well, advisory, is the key in all of our businesses. We're not trying to sell our services. We're trying to solve your problems. And I think in this instance, there's a lot of factors that impact the severity of distress. So, the hardest hit clearly is the hospitality business, hotels, business travel, not bouncing back very quickly. Right behind it, that neighborhood non-grocery anchored retail right behind it is going to be struggling, rampantly. And it's how long can those businesses hold on, underlying them? And then ultimately, if you're an owner of real estate and all of your tenants are going bankrupt and you have a mortgage on it, then, kind of cascades all the way down through. Stimulus, particularly the stimulus 2.0, is meaningful. There are some targeted, between the employee tax credit and PPP2, that with some hospitality magnifiers that are designed to shoot in the arm, in those industries specifically. Obviously, hospitality and tourism is the number one industry we have in the state. So it affects us all pretty, that stimulus disproportionately should come to us. That's a different situation than if it doesn't show up. So I think really trying to be on the front lines of the programs and the happenings, trying to give people as much clarity, as much crystal ball as no one can give a crystal ball, but to the extent you do have some visibility of how other stores are performing or various things that, that are happening. On the banking side, working with banks that have distressed assets, it's really trying to understand their portfolio in much greater detail, the composition of tenants, starting to classify those tenants into, who do we think would be at risk versus, to say restaurants are at risk. That's not true. I know of several restaurants who had the biggest year of their histories in the fourth quarter of last year. I know other restaurants that are closed for good and never coming back. So it really is that nuanced detail of understanding the circumstance in each situation and then trying to figure out probabilities of success and paths around. So it's just having good data and having it in a timely way, I think, is the best thing that we can be doing.
Over the course of your career, you've been honored with multiple awards in leadership in business, including being voted Real Estate Forum's Best Boss of the Year. Through handling the challenges and events of this past year, how have you personally transformed?
You know, leadership is really about service. And I've always felt that, you know, from the very beginning. That's why the company's not named the Andrew Wright Companies. You know, it's about a broader purpose of us all working together for the betterment of ourselves, professionally, personally, and then our communities by extension. And, you know, that I believed in that. And that concept, that ideal never has showed itself in my career like it did in March of this year, because it transcends work. I mean, people are fearful for their personal safety. They're fearful for their loved ones. They're obviously fearful for their financial security, kind of a lot of uncertainty of where to come. And I'm 40, you know, I just turned 40 a few months ago, and this is my second crisis. It's not my first, it's my second crisis that I've had to operate a business through. And, you know, you learn some lessons, right? It's never as bad as you think it's going to be. You know, it's never as good as you think. It's never as bad as you think. It's always somewhere in the middle. And trying to keep a level head, trying to communicate with people more regularly. We did a number of Zoom calls internally, Zoom happy hours. We actually tried to drive the other way, where people had more opportunity to build relationships that had a pre-existing ones. Hard to start new ones, but to build on existing ones. You know, how often do I have wine nights with people that work with me? Or you know, kind of leadership happy hours or coffees or, you know, things that just really propel engagement on a bigger level. And so I would say that really was transformative, because, you know, you have to, in the normal course of our work, we're all focused on the day-to-day activity. But when the work pauses, you know, making sure that you're tripled down in the community of your organization was something that was new to me, and frankly, something that we want to continue to build on. You know, we've talked about, like, we've been back in the office since the beginning of the year, probably leading on that issue. You know, we have lots of safety procedures around the office and deal with concerns on a one-to-one basis. But, you know, trying to drive that continued engagement even beyond COVID through some of these channels is something that we're going to try to keep, right? The silver lining of not all that's happened has been bad. You know, that to me, I think, is just, you know, far and away is what's been different for me.
You have been listening to Invest Insights. Be sure to follow, rate, and review this podcast to hear more. I'm Abby Malone. Thank you for tuning in.